Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks once again for tuning in. We have a great opportunity this hour to get up to date on issues that affect all of us, and even more probably in the weeks and months to come. We're privileged to welcome back a personal friend of mine that we haven't visited for 15 years probably or so. Jordan Lawrence serves as a senior counsel and senior vice president of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom at its Washington, D.C. Regional Service Center there. He's litigated religious liberty, free speech, and marriage cases across the nation since 1984. Earned his law degree from the University of Minnesota back in 1980, I think probably where we first got connected, and is admitted to the bar in three states, the U.S. Supreme Court and municipal federal court, multiple federal courts. And Jordan, it's good to have you back here on Connecting Faith.
Well, it's good to be back in the homeland. And yeah. I grew up here. I was born in Minnesota. And although I live in Washington, D.C. now, it's always good to get back to where I grew up.
Yeah, we're glad to have you in. And maybe before we jump into kind of talking about some cases and some of the specific areas that you're working on, just say a word about ADF. I mean, that's actually, it's Alliance Defending Freedom. It's a little bit of a new name. For one thing, right?
So. Right. It was started back in 1994 by D. James Kennedy, Bill Bright, Dr. Dobson, a few others, to basically help take the fight for religious liberty, for marriage, and for the pro-life cause to the next level. That what they were finding was, and I think this was true because I started litigating religious liberty cases about 10 years before ADF started in 1984, we were underfunded, we were undermanned, and there wasn't a lot of coordination. And ADF has just basically been the entity, the catalyst that has helped the Alliance grow to fight for our religious liberties, for marriage, for the life movement. And it's now the United States, other nations, and we're basically trying to make other people successful, not build an empire, but to help grow an alliance.
It is amazing when you start thinking back how many years we've been in the middle of so many of these fights. And we'll unpack some of those, I guess, as we go along. But if you were to prioritize or maybe look at your desk or file case, are there a top two or three cases, issues that you're addressing? And what would those be today?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. And they happen to basically be right of conscience cases in the area of abortion and in the area of not participating in same-sex wedding ceremonies. The Hobby Lobby case was out there. We won that at the Supreme Court. ADF was not representing Hobby Lobby, but there was a companion case that nobody ever heard about, Conestoga Wood Products. We represented a Mennonite group from a family from Lancaster that had a kitchen cabinet company, and they objected to the Obamacare mandate that they provide for abortion pills. Now, we won that at the Supreme Court for, I think, probably the more difficult group of people to win for, for-profit businesses. But now the nonprofits, Christian colleges, other Christian ministries, orders of nuns, et cetera, are all being required as well to do this. And the Supreme Court at the end of this week on October 30th will be determining which of those cases, if any of them, they'll take. ADF has a few of them. The Beckett Fund has a couple others. And we'll see what they're going to do. And I think they'll take those cases, and I think they're going to grant religious liberty for that. We're also seeing a lot of these right of conscience cases with, I've heard people refer to them as the photographer, the baker, and the cake maker. And I did the photographer case from New Mexico, Elaine Photography. But we're seeing these cases where people are accused of discrimination when they say, I will deal with and provide services for same-sex couples in other contexts, but I cannot do something that either causes me to participate in their wedding ceremony or to somehow further their message that marriage can be defined to include same-sex couples. Those are probably the big ones that we're fighting right now at ADF.
And just to kind of follow up on that, I mean, so many of those things seem like simple logic. I mean, that I guess maybe because we assume that religious liberty has sort of been built into the framework of the Constitution, so why should that really be an issue? But we are seeing, you know, common sense is not all that common anymore, is it?
Well, that's right. And I think that what we're seeing is with a diminishing of people going to church or going to any type of religious, you know, meeting on the weekends or, you know, on their Sabbath day in the United States, the nons rising, that people have no religious affiliation. I think that there's a somewhat of a growing kind of a muscular indifference towards religious groups and therefore religious liberties. They're cranks. They're irritating. They don't play by the rules. They're irritating or whatever. And that is unfortunate that, you know, when we started doing this back in the early 1980s, I think when I was working at the Minnesota State Senate, there just seemed to be much more vigor and common acceptance of a lot of the things that we are arguing for. And now I feel like many of the people we represent are believing what they did 30 years ago, but it's sort of like because the society is moving in a more secular way, we're becoming more and more like the Amish in some ways and going against the grain and having conflicts with governmental restrictions and laws that we in good conscience can't deal with and abide by.
I was going to ask you if, you know, compared to the cases you're doing now, are they significantly different than, you know, 20, 30 years ago? But is it Christians and people still have strong convictions? It's just that there's societal influence is probably pushed much stronger against it. Right?
Yes, I would say that 20, 30 years ago, there were these kinds of rights of conscience cases happening then. But we had more and the cases that I'm saying we had more of, we have them as well today. But they were more cases where the Establishment Clause was being used to say everybody gets this one thing, but we're going to exclude the religious groups. So many of those were equal access cases. There'd be some government facility, a school, a city hall auditorium. Everybody can meet there for their worship services except the religious groups. During the 1980s, and other groups were litigating a lot of those kinds of cases. There are still some of those going on. I've just wrapped up 20 years of a lawsuit against New York City for banning worship services in the Bronx Household of Faith case. But those cases where we're seeing the Establishment Clause used to single out religious groups and exclude them are probably lesser in number than they were 20, 30 years ago, and we're seeing more of these right of conscience cases, which I think were fewer back then.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the Household of Faith case, and you know, 20 years, it reminds me, because how do the courts determine cases, and is there sort of a timeline where it says, you know, it's got to be done by, you know, if we take it, it's going to be done in 3 months or, you know, or 1 year?
Well, it really depends on the nature of the case, and that you can have cases that are over in a couple of months. The Bronx Household of Faith case was unusual that it had this 20-year arc lifespan to it. And, I mean, there were some procedural reasons which would bore the listeners if I tried to explain them because I couldn't translate the legalese sufficiently. But that is definitely unusual when those kind of cases take that long.
Yeah. But is there a matter of coming up with the best sort of compelling brief to get the courts to hear a case that, you know, you're interested in really litigating there?
That is the case at the United States Supreme Court. The lower federal courts, for example, anybody can get in the door there, and they sort of sort the sheep from the goats and the wheat from the tares and then send the cases up. But at the Supreme Court, and this is one of the things that I'm concentrating on a lot now in my work for Alliance Defending Freedom, is our Supreme Court work. That we've had three major wins, that we were the direct guys running the case in the last two terms at the court. We've had other cases where we had major involvement. And that takes a level of expertise. And if this encourages people, I would say that when I started doing this work in 1984, the people who believed in traditional Christian values simply did not have the expertise of dealing with cases at the United States Supreme Court level. And I think that that has all changed, and that the best people we have are just as good as the best people at the ACLU or Lambda or, you know, Freedom From Religion Foundation, et cetera. And that I think that we would be viewed, and I'm trying to say this as objectively and as modestly as possible, that Alliance Defending Freedom are viewed as effective players. They may be, you know, conservative and Christian and all that, but we're viewed as effective players at the Supreme Court. And I'm very proud, I hope in a godly way you can be proud, of the expertise we have developed in that.
Which you really need, don't you, to be able to argue effectively at the Supreme Court level, right?
No, that's exactly right. And I think I just think that there is a lot of times, just to make this a much broader discussion, that many times Christians are not sticklers for excellent quality in what they do. But here, like at KTIS, that the, you know, there's a level of excellence that the that comes in producing radio shows, the programming and all that. And it's just not, you know, you grab a microphone and start talking or putting out some sort of publication, whatever. The same thing is with the Supreme Court. There is definitely a way that things are done, and you need to sort of develop the expertise of the wilderness trail guide to be able to get through it.
We're talking today with Jordan Lawrence. Jordan serves as a senior counsel and senior vice president of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom. That's Washington, D.C. Regional Service Center. And we're going to talk more. We're talking about some of the cases that ADF is dealing with, and more on religious freedom, rights of conscience, and all those things coming up here as we continue on with Connecting Faith. Listen to Connecting Faith, and we've connected with Jordan Lawrence today, and so appreciate the opportunity to reacquaint with Jordan. Been a longtime friend. We haven't seen each other in a long time. He's been arguing cases at the Supreme Court and in Washington, D.C. He serves as the senior vice president and senior counsel of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom in D.C., a graduate of the University of Minnesota Law School, and served working as a an aide in the state senate.
That's right.
Sometime for them,
right,
a long
right.
time ago.
But anyway, a proud graduate of Mount West Tonka High School. There's probably people out there saying, "Where does his voice sound so familiar?" Oh, I remember I went to high school with him out in Mound.
There we go. Well, we're talking about, you know, some of the cases, the issues that Alliance Defending Freedom gets involved in. Could you have predicted the swiftness or the extent of the opposition to the traditional values that have seemed to, you know, even just feels like in the last 6 months, you know, the last year, certainly the last 5 years.
I could not have predicted it. And I do agree with what you're saying, that there just seems to be a growing hostility in a way that I think is something of great concern, but is also an opportunity for Christians to show courage, to have faith in the Lord, to speak out, and that to remember that we have a faith that motivated, for example, I think it was Paul and Silas in Acts 14. I'm doing this off the top of my head, which is a little dangerous. This is when they were in Iconium and Lystra, that they're being stoned by people after they preach the gospel. They get up and they go back. And I haven't had rocks thrown at me for what I believe in. I've been called a lot of bad names, but that to me should not be a sign of a signal for us to pull back, to be scared, but to go forward with all of that. But I do think that you're right. And in fact, one of the things I want to mention, though, about this, if there is any encouragement, is that – so I went to the law school at the University of Minnesota here in 1977 to 1980. And I do a lot of debates at law schools nowadays. So I'm frequently visiting them. And what I think is interesting is that the reluctance people had when I was in law school in the late 70s to speak against Roe v. Wade, to question legalized abortion, that's all total opposite. And back when I was in law school, people couldn't question abortion the way that they can't question same-sex marriage. So I do think that there's these kind of that these movements have a lifespan to them. And I mean, I can now I can remember in first year constitutional law class in 1977, 78, you know, with fear and trembling, raising my hand, speaking against Roe v. Wade. Now I do it all the time when I'm in law schools and nobody says, how dare you question this, you know, holy, sacred decision from the Supreme Court. They'll basically say, like, well, I agree with it. Yeah, but it was, you know, was kind of poorly reasoned and all that sort of stuff. And so there I just think there's some value in persevering in these matters and not to lose sight of what is true.
So will we be able to look back and say that about the same-sex marriage decision in a, you know, a season, whatever that that length of time is, or is, has it the sea kind of changed on that?
Well, I think it will. There will be a day that we look back and say, wow, I just can't believe how crazy our society was. And right now, I mean, to another allusion to the book of Acts, that this is when you do debates on same-sex marriage now, it's kind of like when Paul was in Ephesus and, you know, they have the 2 hours of shouting, you know, yeah. Great is Artemis of Ephesus, great is Artemis of Ephesus. And you can't get a word in edgewise with that. Now, the thing is that I would say is that the 2 hours did come to an end and that you can start reasoning with people. But I think that is so contrary to the way God created us. Male and female, he made us in the image of God. And if anything, that this fight that we're having is pushing us back as Christians to examine the how marriage and being male and female reflects the reality of the Trinity, one God, three persons. They have community. They have relationship. There is difference but unity, just as there are male and female. So if you have a same-sex marriage saying, well, you know, you can have, you know, Christ marrying the church or two Christ marrying or two churches marrying, you know, like that, they're just all interchangeable. Or, oh, a male and female, that's all personal choice. It's, you know, Bruce Jenner, all this kind of transgender stuff. All of that is directly opposite the way God created us. And I would urge any pastors, Bible study leaders, not to back off these important truths, because right now the society is moving in a direction to oppose that. But because it's in our created innate nature, sooner or later, it's got to bounce back to that. You cannot sustain a society on principles that are contrary to how God has created us. And I think that sooner or later that people are going to wake up and say, you know what, this is just an unsustainable ethic to try to run society on.
In the meantime, I guess, I know that you were part of a conference focusing on, you know, maybe how churches and ministries can be prepared or the implications of same-sex marriages, maybe protect against LGBT lawsuits or those things. What advice would you have for ministries, churches, Christian colleges?
Well, I would say first that ADF on our website, has alliancedefendingfreedom.org. We have materials for what businesses should do, what nonprofit religious ministries and churches should do, what small businesses should do to protect themselves. Speaking particularly to churches, though, what they have to do is to make sure they have clear doctrinal statements that they act on about the definition of marriage. And that it's clearly accessible, like in their doctrines, and in churches set up their church government differently. So however it's done, and we kind of go through if you're a congregation-based church, if you're a hierarchical church, you're like with bishops, et cetera, how you would do that. And that to basically stick to the principles. And I think anybody who says, oh, you know, we want to present the gospel, but, you know, stay away from these secondary divisive issues, et cetera, that sort of thing. I just caution people to think that way, that to me, they are just simply giving into pressure to compromise. Because even if you think this is like, we're just going to focus on the gospel of Jesus, you know, died for our sins and rose from the dead to win a salvation and a reconciliation with God. Paul says in Ephesians 5 that marriage of one man and one woman reflects the very gospel itself, that Christ loves the church. So now that's a secondary way that it communicates the gospel preaching and the Bible reading are the main ways. But nonetheless, we distort or limit or hamper people's ability to comprehend the gospel itself if our societies define marriage wrong. And so I don't think you can separate, say, gospel is primary, definition of marriage is secondary. Paul does not say that in Ephesians 5. And I think that that's just something we have to just say, Lord, give us grace and faith and courage to do what's right, even though there's a lot of hostility to that in this society.
Say a word about, and we've got a couple of minutes here before we take a break, but just maybe using the same-sex marriage case as an example. I mean, what argument won the day, or was it just sort of the whim of the judges saying, well, you know, regardless of who had the best, you know, debate or case, this is what we're going to decide?
Well, I was in the courtroom last April when they argued the case, and then in June, at the end of June, when they handed down the Obergefell decision where they struck down four state laws that define marriage as one man and one woman, Michigan and Ohio, Kentucky and Tennessee. And the argument that they used basically was they said that there's a due process right in the 14th Amendment, sorry for the legal mumbo jumbo, that people can marry the person of their choice and that this was being denied. The problem with that is that the Constitution really doesn't speak to that. And they sort of, I think, kind of made it up and made an application of the Constitution that really doesn't go there. They should have just simply left this to the states to work this all out rather than by judicial fiat impose a redefinition of marriage on the whole nation. But the other thing that I would say is this. I think even the premise of what they're saying is wrong, because they'll say, like, well, we deny dignity to same-sex couples if we don't allow them to marry. Well, what about a man and a woman who don't get married but have kids? They are denying dignity to their kids, but we say, well, that's part of their self-autonomy that to pick the person that they love. So if everybody can pick whomever they want and do whatever they want, you're not going to get a consistent set of people choosing lifelong committed marriages. You're going to get people picking one-night stands, cohabitation, abandoning their wife and children, that sort of thing. So that this whole marriage equality thing is really a Ponzi scheme, I think, and people are going to be hurt. And that's when that fruit starts being born, people are going to go back, I think, to the way God made us to be.
Getting a great perspective and insight from Jordan Lawrence. Jordan serves as a senior counsel and senior vice president of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom in their Washington, D.C. Center. And you can find out more, alliancedefendingfreedom.org, if you have questions about that. We're going to jump into some more questions as we talk about religious freedom cases, about life, about marriage, all those things coming up in the moments ahead as we continue here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we've connected today with Jordan Lawrence. Jordan is senior counsel and senior vice president for the Office of Strategic Initiative for Alliance Defending Freedom, Washington, D.C. And you can find out more about ADF at alliancedefendingfreedom.org. I'm just curious, Jordan, maybe before we maybe jump back in some of the cases, are you do you work with businesses, individuals, ministries? Is there do you work with anybody kind of for any kind of situation? Or?
Yes, we do. That is correct. That we view if we can advance religious liberty, if we can advance the principle of life, if we can advance the principle of marriage defined as one man and one woman, we help all of those who are in distress or who have questions or need support, because we feel if people feel isolated, they just lose hope. But if they feel that they are connected in a big alliance and there's others rooting for them and supporting them, they tend to respond with courage and faith, and that's what we're all about at ADF.
So we hear like the Beckett Fund, they were part of the Hobby Lobby, right? I think they're represented.
Yes.
So are there groups like that? So you work together with a variety of Christians or men and women of goodwill?
Yes. Yes, exactly right. So some of the cases we with our own staff attorneys. Other times we will give money to other groups, and other times we just work with them. The Beckett Fund, I would say, is probably one of the finest and most effective religious liberty groups. In fact, I could give, but it would be a boring constitutional law seminar, on some of the cases they've won at the Supreme Court that have really advanced the ball of religious liberty. They're a very fine group. Liberty Institute in Texas, Kelly Shackelford's group is another great one. Jay Sekulow still continues to do some religious liberty work. We all work together, and we're always talking, writing friend of the court briefs in each other's cases, helping each other prepare for cases. And we're about to do appeal a case to the Supreme Court with some Beckett attorneys. And I just had an ACLJ attorney, Jay Sekulow's group, look over a case we're sending up to the Supreme Court. And I think that this working together has been facilitated by Alliance Defending Freedom. And it's just been a really great thing to see that I think we've minimized a lot of the kind of the competition and trying to elbow each other out of the way and just work together for the common good.
And as you said, are we advancing the ball in religious freedom? I mean, are there, you know, we used to, probably 20 years, 30 years ago, we were talking about education and, you know, Christmas and those kinds of things. Are we making progress in some areas?
Boy, I feel like Charles Dickens and, you know, The Tale of Two Cities. It's the best of times and it's the worst of times. That there are some really significant cases that we've won, like the Hobby Lobby case. There's one called Hosanna Tabor, which people's eyes would glaze over. Very important case, protecting church autonomy. Those kinds of cases are really, really big. And the fact that we are even fighting about this. So, like, I mean, here's another thing, which isn't exactly there's more complexity. New York City, 20 years ago, a church could not rent a public school to hold a church service. You know, around here in most places in the United States, it's very, very common, routine, no big deal. It just was simply impossible in New York City. So in the last 20 years, ADF, we filed this lawsuit. 13 years ago, we got an injunction that opened the doors. And it allowed guys like Tim Keller to start planting churches in the public schools, the Southern Baptists, the Assemblies of God. I'm trying to think. I litigated the case. I'm trying to think of some of the other churches. A lot of immigrant churches. I can think of two churches that mainly minister to people, immigrants from the Dominican Republic. And then we ended up, the Supreme Court denied review in the case after we lost at the federal appeals courts, which dissolved this injunction. But then Mayor de Blasio, who had been observing all of this, said, why do we have this crazy rule? Why do we treat the churches worse than everybody else? These are empty buildings on weekends. These eager Christians want to go into many of the poor neighborhoods. This is a win-win. And so within about 2 hours after the Supreme Court declined to hear the case in last March, he issues a press release saying all the churches can stay. We're getting rid of the policy. He basically said the legal department asked me to not do this so they could pursue the appeal and win. But this is a rule that has changed. And the reason I bring that up is we technically do not have a legal precedent, but there has been culture change in New York City where they now view the churches as good neighbors and not as a sort of alien force descending on the community. And guys like Tim Keller and others – Councilman Fernando Cabrera is another guy. He's a pastor and a city council member. I just think really seized the opportunity that we got with this court injunction to really make things different. And it is amazing to me how many churches are meeting in public schools in New York City and then growing, moving out, getting their own buildings and really making an effect for the gospel there in a way that all I did was all the legal mumbo jumbo in court. But it's one of the proudest things I've ever worked on in my whole life.
You know, you mentioned talking about the cultural change, and earlier we were talking about, you know, being able to talk about the Roe v. Wade decision where, you know, 30 years ago it was kind of with fear and trembling.
Right.
So we've seen the videos, Planned Parenthood's involvement in selling aborted baby parts. You know, say a bit about, you know, a case like that. Is there a way that we can, some legal recourse to stop this? And where would you see that going in today's environment?
Let me just say the videos are basically the 21st century version of Uncle Tom's Cabin was, that it reveals the reality of slavery the way that Harry Beecher Stowe's book did to the people in the 1850s, so the horrors of slavery, and precipitated a lot of popular move to get rid of slavery, etc. I think that these videos are serving the same function. To me, I've been involved in pro-life cases. I did not know that Planned Parenthood does different abortion procedures so they're not destroying the bodies of the unborn, and they can harvest the baby's body parts to sell. Now, that to me is ghoulish and scary. And to think that they're receiving like $500 million of federal funding for doing this, and that where the federal government should be directing its money is to these other women's health clinics that have nothing to do with abortion, and take it away from this. And this is something that people can urge their lawmakers to do at both the state and federal levels, is to take away the Medicaid money and other monies that go to Planned Parenthood and give it to groups that actually help women with health needs, and not just try to make lots of money off, you know, abortion and selling baby parts. And Texas, just a few days ago, cut off funding to Medicaid. I think it's about a half dozen states that have done that. And we just got to continue that momentum.
Do you see that issue continuing to get response at the courts? I mean, it seems like, you know, for 40 years, right, more than that, the cases continue to get pushed up toward higher courts, and, you know, we make little bits of progress. So you see this in terms of life issues, some major changes there?
Yes, and I think that what has there's so many directions I could go with that question. It's such a great question, is that ultrasound, I think, has made a huge difference in the whole abortion debate because people can see the victims. And I think that's why, just to contrast it with the same-sex marriage, I think it's going to take a while here before we see the victims of exploitation that I think is inevitably going to come. For example, and then I'll get back to abortion, you need a third party to participate to create kids, and then a woman to bear the child, the surrogate mother or a sperm donor, and then they're pushed aside. The fathers and mothers are pushed aside. So we're going to have victimization as we treat people like commodities. I think it's inevitable. But that's manifest now in the abortion area with these videos. People can see the callousness, the ghoulishness of what's being done with all of this, of, you know, cutting through faces to get organs and this sort of thing. And I think that that's a bit of a game changer. Now, all of this is going on in the culture, and right now there are a number of cases involving abortion at the Supreme Court that we're waiting to see whether they're going to grant review. And the way the Supreme Court has been treating these cases indicates that they're going to. We have abortion restrictions from Texas and Mississippi. That's one set of cases, I think, November 7th. November 6th, the Supreme Court's going to be dealing with them. They've got the HHS mandate abortion pill cases. October 30th, they're going to be deciding those. Then we have, it's kind of a technical case, but the New Hampshire right to life is in this battle with the federal government to get documents about Planned Parenthood funding under a Freedom of Information Act. And please don't turn off the dial since I said a legal term. But all of that case, those kinds of cases, even though it's this technical thing about how you apply the Freedom of Information Act and what the government has a duty to disclose, it's in a context of, oh, it's about Planned Parenthood funding. They're the ones that put out all those videos, or the videos are happening to see all this horrible stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And, they're human beings. I mean, they rule, the judges rule according to the law, but this cultural battle, I think, is also needs to be set in a favorable context when these cases come up.
which I guess brings up one of the questions I had. Are we at the point in our nation and culture maybe where the courts sort of represent the ruling party now? I mean, that they, you know, they're human, they're individuals as well, but it seems like legislation doesn't really end the conversation. It all ends up in the courts.
Well, I think that that's true, and I think it's unfortunate that I think our Constitution has been set up for the state legislatures and Congress to resolve many of these matters. But there's been more and more people deferring to the courts, kicking the football to them to decide these difficult questions. And that's unfortunate. And I hope we can put an end to that or reduce that and get back to a more appropriate constitutional balance.
Yeah. Jordan Lawrence, my guest, we're going to continue another segment here as we talk about what's going on in areas of religious freedom, about the right to life, about marriage, and about the great work of Alliance Defending Freedom. You can find out more at alliancedefendingfreedom.org. Jordan serves as senior counsel and senior vice president of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom in their Washington, D.C. Regional Services Center. And he's joining us today here on Connecting Faith. We'll continue in just a minute. Listening to Connecting Faith, and we are spending some time today considering the issues of religious freedom and about life, defending life, and marriage, and the great work of Alliance Defending Freedom. With us today, Jordan Lawrence, who is a senior counsel and senior vice president in their Washington, D.C. Regional Service Center, the Office of Strategic Initiatives. Maybe just say, what are the strategic initiatives? Are there are those just whatever strategic cases come up that have the most impact for the most number of people? Or
yes, and things that we can do proactively. Is there some lawsuits we could file that would help advance the ball to attack things? And then also, to use a biblical metaphor, to identify cases that maybe are already in the pipeline, but they're one puts to flight 1,000 if we get that. So like, for example, one case we're going to be appealing next week, state of Missouri has a program of recycling tires, and they grind up the tires and turn them into that surface for playgrounds so the kids don't injure themselves. And a Lutheran church in Jefferson City, Missouri, applied to get playground surfacing material from these recycled tires for its the playground of its daycare center. And the state of Missouri said no, that this would promote violate separation of church and state, because it would be government aid to religion. And you think about, okay, the Lutheran kids have to be bruised to able to maintain separation of church and state. And amazingly, as bizarre as that case is, we have lost every step of the way in that case, and we're going to appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm hoping, you know, I pointed out that this case is really great, because it's taking the whole argument of separation of church and state to an absurd extreme, you know, ground up rubber, you know, like we're advancing their religious doctrines by allowing them to, you know, have safe surfaces, soft surfaces for their playground equipment. Just seems ridiculous.
Are there arguments that more often than not win the day? I mean, have you obviously you've been doing this for a long time. You know, maybe some strategies work better than others, but do you win more than you lose?
We do at ADF. I think our percentage is about 75% or 80% of our cases that we win. But the kinds of arguments I think are basically rooted in the First Amendment itself, and which I believe has a lot of Christian values in it. Many of the founders were influenced by the preaching of the Great Awakening in the 1730s through 1760s. And you get concepts of, you know, treat people with dignity. And also, and then so how, you're thinking, like, how does that translate to what you argue in court? Is that one of the things that they would believe is that you cannot coerce people to believe in the gospel, because God has made humans in the image of God, and that they can only be persuaded to accept the gospel. They can't be forced. To force them would be against the very nature of the gospel itself and violate the fact that people are made in the image of God with, you know, independent reason and ability to comprehend. So now that then gets codified into freedom of speech, where people can articulate ideas without government censorship, without government suppression, even idiotic ideas or extreme or wacky ideas, because although I do believe some ideas are better than other ideas, you let the marketplace of ideas sort that out rather than the government picking winners and losers in the debate. And that has strong resonance even with people who haven't even been to church, that they understand that. And we're able to articulate that. And, you know, no one should be forced against their will to tell the story of and celebrate a same-sex wedding ceremony against their will. Now, some of those cases, it's been hard to win those cases, but we're using common, traditional, widely accepted principles of freedom of speech, for example, in that kind of arena to argue for them.
Well, maybe just speaking of coercion, maybe going back to talk about the ACA, the Hobby Lobby case, is that settled? Are there, you know, what are the maybe ongoing outcomes of that? You mentioned that, you know, their courts maybe going to decide to take up another one, but kind of where do you see that going, particularly as it relates to businesses?
Well, this is for businesses, I think we're in good shape. And there's a couple of things about this that I want to say. One of the main reasons why we won that case was that there were alternative ways to opt people out, that they said that they're allowing the nonprofits to opt out. But the other thing, if people feel like, oh, women are suffering or something like this, the Obamacare plan exempted tens of millions of women who work in the workforce. That if a woman worked for a company of 50 or fewer employees, the employer had no obligation to offer the abortion pills. If they had a grandfathered-in plan, which many corporations did, they didn't have to offer these plans to women. So there was just a very patchwork quilt application of their laws, which I think undercuts the claim that the federal government had a cross the board requirement to impose this on people. And I also want to add, like when I hear sometimes, so I hear I've been litigating religious liberty cases since 1984, to assert a religious claim, and some of these like the Indiana law that got amended, unfortunately, I think that it did, and got passed in some other states, they don't operate as automatic get-out-of-jail-free cards. So you can't say, you know, we're going to convict you, arrest you for murder. Oh, I'm an Aztec. I really... it was stabbing someone as a human sacrifice. Oh, sorry, you're off the hook. That's not the way the law operates. It's a defense that sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. If the government has a sufficiently important interest, you're going to lose that. But a lot of times the government doesn't, and I think that was clearly the case in the Obamacare Hobby Lobby case.
Well, they're just asking for at least the opportunity to make their case.
That's right.
That was one of
That's
the issues.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, speaking of cases, you look at sort of the front line, try and predict down the road, are there ethical issues that we, you know, can't really even imagine now that you foresee showing up on the docket sooner than later?
The ones I fear that would happen is, sure, Bible preaching church, you can have a tax exemption for your property and all of this, and you don't have to pay income taxes on what comes in the offering plate. If you don't discriminate in employment on the basis of religion. Oh, your pastor, you require your pastor to be a Christian? No tax exemption. Oh, you oppose same-sex marriage? You're no longer tax exempt. I think licensed professionals, I could see even as attorneys there's a lot of real estate agents, beauticians, dentists, all these licensed people, they could have some sort of you have to bow the knee and say, I'm a supporter of same-sex marriage, or you know, you don't get your professional license or a business license. I can see that, and we're going to have conscientious objections to that. We have constitutional defenses. The one thing that I would say, I think most Americans think let's exempt those people, live and let live. The zealots who favor same-sex marriage want to see everyone's head on a platter. They want to make a public spectacle, a public hanging of these photographers and cake bakers and florists, et cetera. But I think the jury's still out on whether we're going to win or we're going to lose those cases in the long run.
You know, we sort of touched on it earlier in the program, but just thinking, would more Christian lawyers make a difference in the American legal system? I mean, is there one, I guess, you know, impactful strategy that we could be pursuing now that's going to make a difference?
Yes, I think we need more. We need them strategically placed. And let me just also say, I think we need more Christian script writers of movies and television shows. We need more Christians who are air traffic controllers and business owners and working in big corporations and at Starbucks and GM or whatever. And I think that I've been recently convicted of how much I had a bunker mentality, even though I've been doing this for all this. It's sort of like I got my church, you know, we homeschool our kids and all this. And there's kind of this bunker mentality rather than I want to be in the marketplace speaking of these truths to people that really and befriending people. And I think that means we got to the lawyers have to become judges. They have to join the state bar associations. They have to run for the legislature and they have to interact with people. And now I think you present the gospel and the biblical truth in a winsome way, like a C.S. Lewis would. But you also don't back down from that. And I feel that we either get people who are just too gruff in the way they express truth. They just kind of pour it out in raw fashion and don't really think through how to be how a wise man makes knowledge acceptable, or they wimp out and they just want to be everybody's friend, not realizing, like Jesus said in Matthew 10, there is an inherent offense of the gospel. And Jesus in Matthew 10 says, this is my very gross paraphrase, if you're helping the poor, not asking for money, but simply preaching the gospel, people are still going to hate you. So you can't like do the gospel right for everybody just loves you and wants to give you a hug. Now, you can do things out of the flesh that people get turned off by it. But I think we just have to suck it up and say people are going to oppose us until Christ returns.
Yeah. Are people still giving you hugs, or are you, are you sort of become a curmudgeon lawyer after years before the bench?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I was at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania last week speaking, and we had a room full of left-wing students, all, like basically as far away from biblical values as you could think. And by the end of the 2 hours, I think that I was inviting some of them to come and visit me in Washington, D.C., and all of that. And in fact, I enjoyed it so much. I was there to talk about freedom of speech, but we ended up talking about the scriptures. And there was something about what I really love about the doctrine of people being made in the image of God is that even though they had purple hair, one guy objected to me calling him sir. He wanted me to use some gender neutral word to describe him and all this sort of stuff. The fact that they are made in the image of God means I treat them with dignity. And I say, look, I'm appealing to you. There is truth here that I urge you to get saved from your sins by Jesus Christ is worth considering. And it isn't like some stupid, dumb fundamentalist thing like that. And I think by the end of it, they were just kind of stunned that somebody would treat them with respect, although still disagree with them. And I think we need more of that. And not that I'm a perfect example, but I just try to be aware of what's going on around me and speak truth to it and pray that God had opened the eyes of the people that are there and that I'm not the offense, that the gospel is the thing they have to deal with.
Well, may your tribe increase, Jordan. It's good to visit with you again.
Well, it's good to be here.
Jordan Lawrence, Senior Counsel and Senior Vice President of the Office of Strategic Initiatives for Alliance Defending Freedom in their Washington, D.C. office. You can find out more about the great work of ADF, AllianceDefendingFreedom.org. You've been listening to Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's show, you can always check out the interview. We post the podcast online at myfaithradio.com. Click on the Connecting Faith show page.